This is the first time for me being here in your congregation. I do see some familiar faces and some friends and even some family. So it's a real blessing to be here. Give you greetings from our congregation there in State College, Pennsylvania, followers of Jesus Congregation. Some of you might know State College, Pennsylvania as Penn State, you know, out at Penn State or Happy Valley. Our house is not that far from town, and we can see the stadium and so other parts of downtown. And you know, there's it is a good place to live. And many people, there's a lot of prestige there. There's a lot of wealth there. People come there to get status. Sports is huge, right? Penn State football. Is well known. Many people travel from all over Pennsylvania and around the world, really, to come to Penn State games. I think I've never been in the stadium. We sometimes call it the idol on the hill. They're putting $700 million into that stadium right now, and they can pack 111,000 people just into the stadium. And so on game day, our town is pretty crazy. And so, thank you, brother. And so I've said, some people call it Happy Valley, but in ways maybe it's Poverty Hollow. There's a lot of poverty of soul there. And oftentimes we think of poverty maybe in just the physical sense of somebody who doesn't have enough food or doesn't have a place to live. But if you've read any community development type books, When Helping Hurts by Brian Fickrett is a really good one. If you want to read a book that will challenge you on how you can serve people right here in your community, read that book, because he helps you understand that poverty is more than just physical things. As Americans, we have a lot of poverty in relationships, a lot of poverty in just connection and with God, of course. So let's jump into my message here. On March 11, 2011, a series of events by the devastating 9.0 earthquake in Japan caused one of the worst nuclear accidents the world has ever seen. The tsunami that followed the earthquake knocked out the cooling system for the Fukushima nuclear plant, making it the toughest and the most difficult crisis for Japan since World War II. Some 80,000 people were forced to evacuate from a vast swath of land around the reactor as engineers battled radiation leaks, hydrogen explosions, and overheating fuel rods. And they had no idea when, if ever, they could return to their homes that had been in their families for generations, communities, and to their businesses. And things got worse. The radiation spread well outside the mandatory evacuation zone, nestling in hot spots and contaminating the ground in which was largely an agricultural area. Excessive radiation levels were found in beef, vegetables, milk, seafood, and water. But the response by the Fukushima nuclear crisis by the government was very slow. However, Abe, a Japanese entrepreneur, in a valiant effort to lift the spirits of area residents as well as lighten the impact of radiation, began growing and distributing sunflowers. He and his volunteers grew about 200,000 sunflowers and distributed millions of seeds, resulting in around 8 million sunflowers growing in and around Fukushima. But why sunflowers? So sunflowers can extract nuclear metals from deep in the soil, purifying the ground. And this was discovered at Chernobyl in 1986 when there was a nuclear accident there. However, as Abe was buying seeds and growing sunflowers and motivating hundreds of volunteers to get out and plant them, Japanese scientists were carrying out tests to see whether these sunflowers could actually remove contaminants from the soil. But Abe, true to character, did not wait for the results. believing that by taking action, he could help battered local towns shake off a sense of stagnation and give them hope for the future by doing something about this ominous crisis. It was a tangible way to combat the invisible radioactive snowstorm. His plan worked. Soon there were cheerful fields of sunflowers tucked between deep green hills and lush forests. The soil was being purified, and people were finding the strength and hope to press on. In times of great need, we don't rise to the challenge. We fall to the level of our preparation. We fall to the level of our commitment to our love for whatever issue is facing us. And as we see in the case of Chernobyl Abe, he fell to that love, that commitment to his people, and he empowered people to get out and plant millions of sunflowers, resulting in not only beauty, but actual change happening. And it was proven that that happened. So, what about us? Do we live in a time when there is Chernobyl crisis around us? You know, I mentioned a little bit, I was being a little bit prophetic about Penn State University. I talked about the idea of poverty there. And there's much, much brokenness. And I could tell you that I believe deeply the soil at Penn State and State College is very corrosive. There's many, many needs there. And I would like to suggest, too, that right here in your town, there's that same reality. There's that same problem. Actually, you know what? It's right here. It's in my heart, and it's in our hearts. So we have a great need around us. The world, our secular world, is set against the ways of Eden, the ways of God on earth. And so we have a battle on our hands. We have a Fukushima on our hands. There's wars and rumors of wars. There's broken families. There's rampant sexual brokenness. There's addictions. There's mental health crisis. There's loneliness. And in the last 15 years, we've seen a tectonic shift in our world globally. Since 2010 to 2025, one of the hugest changes that we've encountered, and this is in the world, in the history of the world, in just the last 15 years, the internet went from like on a computer, well, it kind of hit mainstream, you could even argue, and then it went from a computer, and it went into our hands and into our pockets. And now this says that the average teenager, by the time he will turn 30, will have spent 30,000 hours on social media. And that's just social media. And the average American spends 6 to 9 hours a day staring at a device. And small children, 4 minutes outside and 4 hours on a phone on average. Okay? 4 minutes outside, 4 hours on a phone. And I travel the world with my work with All Nations Bible Translation. And it doesn't matter, you can be in the back 40 of Indonesia, Africa, and there's the phone is ubiquitous. And actually, it's almost worse than some of the, it's like the phone came and now their children just sit on it. And they have no knowledge about some of the ways that's messing up their brains. So we're more connected than ever. And yet we've never been so disconnected. There's 40 million people in our world, in the United States, 300 million people approximately, 40 million who have anxiety disorders. And a lot of that is due, you could point to some of the addiction to just being online and just the disconnection. And also, just yesterday I was reading an article too, there's around 40 million people who have really went from being calling themselves a Christian to totally walking away from the church. They're no longer professing anything. There's this huge shift. Now, there's also a quiet revival going on, especially among young men. That's really exciting. Maybe we'll touch on that later. So there's some hope. There's some things moving. But many people, though, are walking away, and especially among young women, actually. It's been like in the Penn State, like the ages of 19 through 22, in that range, there's many young women who are really moving away from Christianity, but there's a movement of men back towards Christianity. It's an interesting phenomenon. So the essence of what it means to be human is under attack in our modern 2025 world. The thief comes only to steal, kill, and to destroy. John 10:10. So the enemy is stealing our time, killing our relationships, and destroying our peace. And so we are in a spiritual warfare. However, there's much hope, and some of you maybe follow the Advent calendar, the month of December. This past week, I think the focus was on hope. So Advent is about waiting. Advent is Latin for waiting, waiting for the coming Redeemer, for Jesus. And so it kind of helps put yourself into the shoes, into the sandals of the Old Testament people as they waited for Christ to come. And so there's much hope. Christ is coming. Yes, he is. His second coming. Isaiah says, Isaiah, of course, if you're following Advent calendar, you'll be in Isaiah a lot. The gospel of Isaiah. He's helping people. He's prophesying that coming Messiah. And he says this in Isaiah 43:19, which maybe I could call this my text verse. And he says this, "For I'm about to do something new." Now this is God speaking to Isaiah. "See, I have already begun. Do you not see it? I will make a pathway through the wilderness. I will create rivers in dry wasteland." And so I was just here talking about some of the brokenness in our world, but we have so much hope. But how do we do that? How do we actually get out and bring hope? How do we bring hope right here in our families, in our churches, and then into our communities? This is Mission Sunday, right? We're thinking about outreach, looking out from us, which is a very, very important aspect of being a follower of Jesus. And so when God sees an army, we see mangled, broken lives. When God sees a haven for birds and cattle and humans, an oasis in the desert, we see just cracked, baked clay. And so it can seem helpless, it can be debilitating, and we just make our driveways longer, make our tables shorter, build our fences higher. Francis Schaeffer says this. He says, "Biblical orthodoxy without compassion is surely the ugliest thing in the world." As Anabaptist people, we do have an incredible faith tradition. We care a lot. At times, it feels like there's a lot on the line. Okay, we want to be people who are people of the book, people of the new covenant, people who are really living out what God is calling us to do. And that's right, and I love that. I want to be part of that. But if we don't have compassion, we become the ugliest people in the world and the most broken. Tim Keller says this. Now, he's a late Tim Keller. He was a man who went to Manhattan. He was in his maybe late 30s. He felt called to Manhattan, and Manhattan there in the early 90s, I believe, was just a place of materialism. There was Wall Street. There was almost no churches, and he felt called to go there. And people said, "What? You're going to Manhattan? That's just materialistic people. You're going to have a really hard road to hoe." And he says, "I know it will be, but I feel called to go there." And today, I believe the church he founded is like 40,000 people. Redeemer Presbyterian Church, I believe. And he went there preaching a fairly conservative, if you will, gospel. Like, it wasn't some kind of liberal gospel. It was pretty conservative in a lot of ways. Ways that we disagree with, but yet ways that we can really embrace the idea of marriage is a man and a woman, some of those things. So he went there with a fairly conservative gospel, and a church sprung forward and is a vibrant church today. And before he died, he wrote a series of articles. And out of this one article, I pulled this quote. He says this, "The Christian church in the West faces the most post-Christian, deeply secular culture in history. It has not yet developed a way to do evangelism with the secular and with the nuns, people who say there are no religion, that really gains any traction and sees people coming to Christ. He goes on to say in the article, quote, mobilization of lay people in evangelism is essential. Okay? Mobilizing lay people, just the common people, not the person with a pulpit or a podcast, but the person who's just that normal person sitting in the pews who goes out and has a day job. He says we need to mobilize those people as in the early church. And the context or the platform that we will use will show, needs to show, and to demonstrate to deeply skeptical people that Christianity is respectable, desirable, and believable. And so, how do we in our world work these things out? How can we be a Chernobyl Abe? And so I have just a little, as an object lesson here, a bouquet of sunflowers. And my title this morning is this. It's called A Creative Resistance. A Creative Resistance. And so in many ways, we need to rise up. We need to be done with lesser things. But yet, we need to embrace that compassion there, as Francis Schaeffer so well challenged us with. And so I have 3 points that we want to look at here this morning. They begin with E. Number one is extend your table. Number two is exercise daily hospitality. And number three is engage in dignifying conversations. And these 3 points are points that any one of you can do, whether you're a child or whether you are an older adult. These aren't fancy things. These are just very simple things. So number one, let's jump right in. Extend your table. How many of you have a table in your home? I wouldn't even ask you to raise your hand because every one of you would raise your hand, most likely, that you have a table in your home. We're so used to that in our homes because there are strong homes. There's tables there. To be seated at a table is to be human. Because we're made in God's image, and because He has created us, in the fancy word of Latin, imago Dei, the idea of God's image, image bears, or like Him, therefore we desire community, we desire connection, and that's around food, and it's at a table with those that we love. Because God's like that. Psalm 23:5. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You have anointed my head with oil. My cup runs over. And we could just go through scripture. We don't have time to do that here this morning. But we can begin to see this word table just keeps popping up. Popping up. That table is there. Jesus actually has this great teaching that I love. As a cafe owner especially. He says this, for who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Do you see a lot of millionaires being servers at restaurants? Okay, even in that time, though, this was a rhetorical question. Everybody knew that, the day of servants. Of course not. The one who's at the table is the greatest. Of course. And he goes, and Jesus goes on, he says this, now pay attention to this. It is not the one who is at the table. I'm sorry. I am not the one who's at the table. I'm sorry. This is a rhetorical question. He goes, is it not the one who's at the table that is the greatest? Then he goes on, but I'm among you as the one who serves. So here we have this beautiful idea that the creator of the world, that God in human flesh, looks at himself as being almost lesser than we're greater than him, and we're seated at the table, and Jesus is serving us. So the idea here, we're thinking about planting some sunflowers. We're thinking about rising to the challenges that face us as a people in our day. And we're thinking about the idea of extending your table. A table is symbolic of family, acceptance, friendship, connection, protection, worship, communion. A table is a place where Christ can be embodied in the world through blessing, breaking, giving, and nourishment. So we're thinking about the idea of table. Now, what about extend? How many of you have a table that extends? Again, kind of a dumb question almost in this group. Most of us have these epic tables that go a whole mile almost. I mean, there's not many places in the world you get to see an Amish-made table like we have where they go on forever. And then maybe you'll put on another, add it on yet, and you have these big, long, that's amazing, okay, extension. And so I want to suggest to you that the idea of tables extending really is what God is calling us to do here. Some of us might not own our own table. You might be a single man or a single lady. You might be still at home yet, but we all have tables and we all can extend them to those around us. And I believe that really actually captured at the heart of who God is this idea of extending the table and making that table longer. Because God is not willing that any would perish, but that all would come to repentance and live. And as we just exercise the simple practice of table extension, God's kingdom can come in many ways. We could go to Luke 14 there and the sobering words of Jesus saying, if you're inviting people to your table that are going to invite you back, whatever. Anyone does that. But when was the last time you invited people to your table that will not be able to invite you back? A sobering challenge. Table extension is going where we haven't went before. It means being in San Diego serving Afghans. It means going to Harrisburg. It means going right into your community. So a challenge for you to think about is, what does your table look like in your home? When was the last time you had people there who would not invite you back? The most powerful and often neglected sacrament we have is the table in our home, the table for our neighbors, the table for our employees or coworkers, the table for those on the outside. And so, thinking of some quick action points here, how can you extend your table? Well, my first point is pretty simple, and that is begin to pray about how can I extend my table? I think about the time that I was headed to our cafe one Saturday morning. The cafe was already open, and I was going to be hopping into the register and running it. And Saturdays are very busy, and I just knew that I probably won't have a whole lot of time to interact with a lot of our guests. And I was feeling kind of in a barren time in my life with evangelism. And I said, Lord, if I could just say, just talk 1 minute with somebody, that would be amazing. And literally, as I walked up to our cafe and laid my hand on the door, this gentleman accosted me. He would come out. He had his food. He was getting a takeout order. He was walking up the sidewalk. I'd noticed him, but I hadn't paid much attention. But he turned around and came back to me, and he goes, hey, who are these people here? And he said, or do you work here? I mean, he must have somehow figured out that I fit in there. And said, yes, we talked a little bit. And within 10 minutes, we had a 10-minute conversation. He was an agnostic. He was just passing through and found our cafe on Google, stopped by, and he was probably never going to come back again. And we dove deep. In 10 minutes, I've never had such a deep conversation, engaging conversation with somebody as that time. We cut to the quick. I mean, we went deep fast. And it was one of those really divine moments. And I thank the Lord for that. It was an answer to prayer. So pray, okay? Pray about that. Who could I invite into my home? Where are those people on the outside around me? One thing we've done with our church is we've created a regular friendship week. This happens every other month. We have a week in our church where we announce it, and we all attempt in our own ways to invite strangers up to our tables. And then twice a year, we do a friendship picnic together, and we try to get those people we're befriending into our picnic and around their church, something that we've done to kind of help create that awareness of us reaching out. Okay, I better keep moving along. I could say a lot more here. Number two, so we looked at extend your table. Number two is exercise daily hospitality. So a really quick story here that impacted my life tremendously. This thing's kind of annoying in my way, maybe a little bit. So just, you know, we're thinking about planting sunflowers, right? So I was in Iraq, in 2019, in northern Iraq, Kurdistan. There was a team there working with Yazidis, and they needed a Bible in their language, and so they reached out to All Nations Bible Translation saying, hey, come check this thing out. And so myself and another brother went there. We were there for a number of days. At that base, there was this older gentleman, an Anabaptist brother. He was a widower, but was there serving these people in a beautiful way. 70 years old, big white beard. And he told me there about midweek, he said, on Saturdays, I hike way back into the mountains to this ancient village, and you can come with me. I thought, oh, great, I'd love to do that. Later that week, the administrator was telling me, he goes, hey, he said, whenever this gentleman goes back there, we always hope he returns. Because back in those mountains is where Iranian militias and all kinds of more radical Muslim groups are. And so we always hope he comes back. And so Saturday morning, I decided to go along, and we head back into these mountains, and we get back there quite a ways back in, and he tells me, he goes, hey, Brian, he said, okay, you see that next mountain over there on that corner? Right there is this ancient old village that Saddam Hussein blew up because they were a village of dissenters. And he said, that's where we're going. There's this beautiful artesian well there, and we'll fill up our water bottles and come back. And I'm there looking, and I said, hey, brother, I'm seeing some people there. I can just see little figures moving. He goes, oh, occasionally there'll be a sheep herder bring his herd of goats or something. Just occasionally I see a sheep herder back here. I said, well, it's sheep herders. Okay, there's people there, like a herd of people. I'm not seeing any goats, but I'm seeing people. And by that time, he was already headed down the mountain. So I headed after him. And so I'm a little scared because 6 years ago, I didn't have much white hair, okay? I was like prime target for a Muslim group, a militia. Middle Eastern people, Muslim people really respect elders. And so this administrator had said, if they see this old brother, they'll let him come back. They won't take him. They respect him. So I'm thinking, oh no, this could be really scary. So we climb the mountain, we come around the corner on this little trail, and right ahead of us here is where these people are, and every fiber in me is watching to see what is going to happen. What are they going to do to me? And we pop around, I see this group of men here, and I quickly scan the area for more people, a couple guys over here, oh, there's some guns there, not good. And I come back. About that time, there's this gentleman getting up, and he's coming towards us. And he has his hands out like this. He's saying, welcome, welcome. He's speaking in English. He's a Kurdish man, but he's speaking in English. Welcome. And other men pop up, and they said, sit down, sit down. They're all smiling. Most of them can't speak English, but they're all kind of gesturing. One guy goes over. He puts on more fuel on the little fire they have for their chai. I mean, these guys are dedicated to drinking chai. They pack a kettle back in the mountains with them just to drink chai. And so I'm a big coffee drinker. Like, wow, that is amazing. I mean, they have all the stuff with them, and so they put more wood on the fire, and pretty soon we're seated there. They're serving us more chai. We have this naan or bread, Middle Eastern bread. There we have like goat cheese, and they have roasted walnuts. And we're sitting there on this old ledge, ancient village. There's some old olive trees around it. You can kind of look out across the valley and see like over there's a Tigris River and Mosul, which was Nineveh. And I look around like, man, we're having the most epic picnic ever. Like, we're sitting there being served by these Muslim guys. And so at that moment, I realized the relief that I was experiencing. And I was remembering, like, I felt very dangerous, in a dangerous place. I felt like I was on the outside. I was on the outside. I was of a different color. I was of a country that, you know, is often looked at as the great harlot, the devil in Muslim eyes. You know, back in America, I'm white. In the United States, I'm 6 foot tall. Like, I got all kinds of, if you want to call it, privilege here in America. But there was none. But I experienced this welcome. So we're thinking of this idea of exercising daily hospitality. When was the last time that you welcomed somebody when they maybe felt scared? That could happen right here in this room. And so for a little bit, let's think of the idea of hospitality. When you think of hospitality, what do you think of? I always think of that story. But too many times we think of just like, well, maybe a Sunday lunch, or, you know, we think of, you know, if you're involved in the cafe world like I am, you think of the hospitality, a restaurant industry, the motel, the hospitality industry. It has really lost its teeth, if you will. And so I want to take us just for a moment to think about the Greek word, the biblical Greek word for hospitality, and that is philia xenoth. So in Greek, I think there's like 5 or 6 words to describe what we use as one word, the word love. And so there's like 5 or 6 different words, but there's the one word is philia, which means brotherly love. So think of Philadelphia, right? The city of brotherly love. Well, not so much, but all right. And then, it means to love as a family member and those around you as family. And so philia xenoth, and xenoth is the Greek word for stranger. Okay, so it means to love a stranger as a brother, as a family member. That's the Greek word for hospitality. Now, there's a word I would like to juxtapose here. So we think of philia xenoth, the Greek word for hospitality. What is the Greek word for the opposite of that? Can somebody tell me? It's thrown around in pop culture. Here we often the left, the liberal, are saying of the right, you are, blah, blah, towards the immigrants. Anybody? Yeah? No. Xenophobic. Thank you. You are xenophobic. Okay? So, philia xenoth, xenophobic. All right. Does anybody have any phobias here? I do. I'm scared of mice. If I would see a mouse on the floor, I would probably climb up on here, and I would say sorry later. In our family, my wife and our children, they kill the mice. They literally chase them and kill them with their feet. And I'm like, where's the highest point around here? All right, so I have a phobia of mice. I'm a scared of mice. And so people who are xenophobic are scared of what? Strangers. And in the life of Jesus, do you think that is befitting for him or for his disciples to be xenophobic, to be fearful of strangers? So that's an opposite idea. And so may God help us not to be xenophobic, but to be those of hospitality, to love strangers. And so it's more than just a Sunday lunch. It is just this deep commitment to being kind to those who are on the outside. And the idea of philia xenoth, the idea of hospitality in that Greco-Roman world was a scandalous idea, because you were taught that a stranger is danger. Literally. The world was not pluralistic then like it was now, for the most part. Now you move into big cities, they sure were. But in general, your little villages, your towns outside of Jerusalem, you saw a stranger, you're like, let me keep my eye on that guy. Who is he? Okay, so it was somewhat radical then, just as it is today. We are to love the stranger. And of course, again, we could look through Scripture and we could just see in the Old Testament, God commanding his people to be kind to the stranger, to take care of them. Because he said, remember, one time you were exiles in Egypt. You were in Egypt. You were a stranger there. So remember that you are to be kind to strangers. Place in the New Testament, there's teaching Hebrews 13, 1 through 2. Let brotherly love continue. Don't neglect to show hospitality. Don't neglect to show filial zenoth. For by doing this, some have welcomed angels as guests without knowing it. Of course, referring back to Abraham, who was an amazing example of hospitality. And the early church, in many ways, the early church changed the world. Their success is said it was because of their hospitality. And church historian Rodney Stark says this: Christianity revitalized life in Greco-Roman cities by providing new norms and new kinds of social relationships able to cope with the many urgent urban problems. To cities filled with the homeless and the impoverished, Christianity offered charity as well as hope. To cities filled with newcomers and strangers, Christianity offered an immediate basis for attachment. To cities filled with orphans and widows, Christianity provided a new and expanded sense of family. To cities torn by violent ethnic strife, Christianity offered a new basis for social solidarity. And to cities filled with epidemics, fires, and earthquakes, Christianity offered effective nursing services. Does anybody know what is the meaning, like the Latin meaning of a hospital? Christians are the ones who started hospitals. Does anybody know what that word means? A hospital ties into hospitality. It's like a place to take care of a stranger. That's where that idea comes from. And so Christianity, in many ways, changed the world in the first couple hundred years by just simple hospitality, love of stranger. And so, I have a little roadmap for you here. I call it the Emmaus Road Map, the Emmaus Road Hospitality Map. So in Luke 24, we see Jesus coming and walking with two disciples that are on their way to Emmaus, right? It's a couple-day walk, I believe. And they're walking. And can someone tell me, if you would see them, what would you think about them? Are they happy? Enjoying the scenery? What was the first question that Jesus asked them as they were walking along? Why are you troubled? What is wrong with you? Because these disciples were sad because Jesus, their Messiah, had just been killed on the cross. And so they were heading back all dejected. And they were walking along. That was their way of getting around, right? And Jesus comes in beside them in his resurrected body, but they don't know it, walking beside them, just a mundane walking, all right? Walking along, he asks a question, and he said, what, you haven't heard? He said, you haven't heard? What's going on? And then Jesus does what? What does he do? This is a really important hint here. Did he make a comment? Just say something? He said something, but it was another question. So he asked two questions. Why are you guys troubled? When was the last time you asked someone why they're sad? Why are you sad? So you ask him that question, and then says, what's going on? Tell me about it. No, I haven't heard. What things? And actually, if you go there and count the words, Jesus says like 16 words in English, and then those disciples recorded say like 160 words. So what is he doing? Asking questions, and then listening. Okay? So I call it the Emmaus Road hospitality map. So there's three four-letter words I want you to think about in practical ways for you to extend your table. I'm sorry, for you to exercise daily hospitality. So the first one is walk. Okay? Walk. What are some ways that you walk with people? Could you find more ways to walk with people? And remember, this walking is mundane. It's not walking in the temple courts. It's just walking on this gravel little road headed to this little no-name place, Emmaus. So find ways to walk with people, and then find ways to talk with people. And remember, 16 to 160, all right? And remember, questions, all right? Asking questions. Actually, I have a book here that I always like to refer to. I'm pretty sure I had it in here. There we go. It's actually this little book. It's called The Six Conversations by Heather Holman, who's actually a Penn State professor at Penn State in our college. She has now taught, her and her husband have taught three different workshops at our cafe in the evening. We call it the Better Conversations Workshop. And this book, she's a conservative Christian, and this book is based on from a biblical worldview on how to have conversations with people. And she teaches like in the Schreyer Business College, just like this elite business college within Penn State, and she teaches these biblical truths to her students. It's such a neat person and a really good book, The Six Conversations. Get the book, read it. It'll save me a lot of words, and I don't have much time for many more words. I need to stop and listen here pretty soon, all right? So, walk, talk, and then what do you think is the third one? Four-letter word. Here. That's good. I like that one. But it's actually not the one I'm looking for. So he walked, he talked, and then what did he sat down, and they broke bread. And in the breaking of bread, their eyes were opened. This is Jesus. Actually, what's really funny is that story, too, is that Jesus was like a continue on. Like they were getting off the off-ramp, those two disciples, to go for the place. And he actually, he was going to continue. And they're like, no way, you come with us. Because they were just loving talking with Jesus. Like, no way, you come with us and spend the night with us. And so Jesus, okay, whatever you say. And they sit down and they have this meal together. And it's in the breaking of bread that they see who this is. There's something really, really profound there. But time isn't going to let us talk much more about that. So think about ways, how can you walk, how can you talk with people, and how can you dine with people? The Emmaus Road Hospitality Roadmap. Finally, actually, one little quote here. Rosaria Butterfield, for some reason, Lyndon said I should bring books along to recommend. Does he do that kind of thing around here? So, you all probably have heard of this book. It's kind of become somewhat popular, which is great. Rosaria Butterfield, The Gospel Called the House Key. She says this. She says, hospitality is not PhD Christianity. It's ABC Christianity. It's basic, central. It's the beginning of Christianity. All right. Lastly, number three is engage in dignifying conversations. So another quick story from the Middle East. I was not at this story, thankfully. But this happened about 3 years ago when Hamas stormed Israel that terrible morning that kicked off a war that's still going. Hamas militants toting grenades stormed a house, a lady who lived in this house, and her name was Rachel. She was an Israeli. right on in one of the kibbutzes, it's called, these little towns, you know, in the along the border there with Gaza and Israel, where they did farming. And Hamas stormed in her house, toting grenades. And Rachel, who was known for her hospitality and generosity, somehow was able to engage these Hamas militants in a way that kept them from destroying her. And so, she ended up hosting a 20-hour tea party as gunfire raged outside. After one of the grenade-toting gunmen struck her across the face with the butt of his gun, Rachel soothed him. She served the militants canned pineapple, tea, and her signature Moroccan cookies. She sang to them in Arabic songs, and they replied with Hebrew ones. She offered the men Coke Zero, but when they said they preferred Coca-Cola, she obliged. She goes on to say, after they drank and ate together, these men became calmer. At one point, one said, "You remind me of my mother." And I told him, "I'm really like your mother. I'm here to help you. I'll take care of you. What do you need?" Later, reflecting on this experience that she actually was able to get out of, she said this. She said, "I started having conversations, and at one point, I even forgot that they were Hamas militants." In other words, these people just became kind of like me, and I'm sure it was reciprocal, because these men never killed her. They were actually killed later because Rachel's son was involved with the Israeli military, and they figured out what was happening, and they were able to storm the house at a second's notice and take out these militants. Rachel actually met with the president of the United States at that time later because she was kind of hailed as this hero. But it was like life or death conversations, right? Have you ever had life or death conversations like that? But it's really who she was, okay? So she was, I don't think she was a Christian. I'm sure she's Jewish. I don't think she was a Jewish Christian. But she was just showing them kindness. She engaged in dignifying conversations. And so I had this little line, small talk is not small. Singing songs in their other languages, what does that do when Rachel sang in Arabic? It showed them that she cared about them. She knew Arabic, somehow knew their songs. It showed them kindness, it showed them dignity. So as you think about people around you, how can you engage in dignifying conversation? How can I engage in dignifying conversations? I mean, God, what did God do in the Garden of Eden, which was like this little temple that he planted? God was there, and he walked with them, and he talked with them in the cool of the day. And even to this day, Hebrews 1, verses 1 through 2, it says this, God, who in various times and in various ways spoke in times past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the worlds. And so human connection, as Margaret Wheatley says, is the most ancient and easiest way to cultivate conditions for relationships. If we can sit and talk together, we become connected. And so Heather in this book lays out 4 points. She calls it 4 mindsets for having engaging conversations. And I won't have time to unpack these different mindsets, but there are 4 of them. It's be curious, believe the best, express concern, and share your life. Be curious. Sometimes curiosity is really hard. All right, it's easy to make judgments, conclusions. Sometimes it's really hard to believe the best, right? Express concern? Wow, I might get pulled into that. That might take some time. Share your life? That's scary. Share stories of my life? Yes, do that. I have an atheist man I meet with regularly at Sowers, and I had to share with him. We get in all kinds of conversations. And one day, just because I was kind of feeling burdened about this, I shared with him how some of our neighbors didn't like us. We had just moved into a new house. And isn't that kind of sad? I'm up here telling you how to be good missionaries, and my neighbors didn't like us. And big conversation. And I shared this with him. And it was very interesting, because he soon started to problem solve with me, figure out how I could make my friends like me, or my neighbors like me better. He shared some things that I probably wouldn't do either as a Christian, maybe that he thought I could do because of the situation. But anyhow, I shared my life, and he began to share these. He began to help me, and he even was texting me later, and it was really special. And I realized later that what happened was it made a connection. All of a sudden, I was now just a regular human. I wasn't some perfect person. I had lots of children who liked climbing trees and building things and were loud and noisy like their dad. And, you know, some neighbors didn't like that. I was just a regular person. And so share your life. All right. Well, it is 11:30, 28:32. And I think I've fully maxed my time out here. Okay? So, what are the sunflowers that you're going to plant this week in the corrosive soil of this town, of my heart, of our hearts? Are you going to sit back and analyze and be slow to move forward, take a back seat, be skeptical, be cynical? Or will you be like Abe, Fukushima Abe, and step at the plate and begin planting sunflowers, encouraging those around you, challenging those around you to do the same, equipping them, being willing to be a big failure? God is calling us in our day to be his people, his hands and his feet in our communities. And as Rosaria says, it's not PhD Christianity, it's ABC. It's those simple ways: extending your table, exercising daily love of strangers, praying about how you can be the hands and feet of Jesus, and engaging in that small talk that often isn't small. And God bless you as you serve him here. I'll turn my time back over.